Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. We've been riveted to an evolving national story. Racial unrest, our nation divided, the Capitol under siege, a second impeachment, the economy sputtering, and of course, a 100-year storm in the arena of public health. We sometimes forget to mind the store and see just what's happening at home, as profound social changes have a way of leaving imprints on our institutions, in the way our government works, and yes, in the workplace. For the past few years, we've seen adjustments in the way we've treated historical figures, the relations and expectations between races, ethnicities, and genders, from anti-harassment laws to the Black Lives Matter movement, to the pandemic, to a sluggish economy, and a recognition that corporate boards don't reflect the community with all of its members. So tonight, as we start a new year, we're once again drawn to the labor and employment arena to see just what changes these events have left behind in the workplace. That's your workplace and mine. And as always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're in the Bay Area, if you're outside of the local calling area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guest cannot give you specific legal advice. We don't have all of the salient facts of your specific situation, but we're happy to share with you the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making. You can call us with any question of labor and employment law. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. So to help guide us through this overview, Wendy Lazerson is the co-chair of Sydney Austin's Labor and Employment International Practice Group and a partner in Sydney's San Francisco and Palo Alto offices. She also serves on the firm's COVID-19 task force. In addition to practicing law, Wendy is the local chair of the Committee for the Retention and Promotion of Women. A partner in the firm, Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, Romo, Thomas Lenz handles all aspects of labor and employment law issues and heads the firm's traditional labor and National Labor Relations Board practices. He works with employers in all major industries across California and the West, and teaches the Alternative Dispute Resolution Program at my alma mater, USC Law. With offices in San Mateo, Shivani Sitaria has focused her entire legal career on employment law. She founded Shivani Sitaria Law Offices, conducting workplace investigations, providing advice and counsel, as well as training on employment laws to employees and employers alike. And all of my guests tonight are members of and appear courtesy of the Labor and Employment Law section of the California Lawyers Association. Shivani, Tom, Wendy, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You know, we've all faced adjustments to the pandemic. For close to a year, I've not had a single guest in the studio with me. Many folks now work out of the home. Many are not working at all. I'd like to start with some of the changes that COVID-19 has made in the workplace. One of the obvious questions that has not yet come up, I wouldn't imagine it's come up much, but it's about to. Can an employer require their employees to get the COVID vaccine? Who'd like to speak to that first?
I'll take a crack at that question because it's not necessarily an easy question. As you say, employers have not had to make concrete decisions yet, but they're all thinking about it with the hope that we will all be back in the workforce soon. And one little twist is that while employers generally, you know, do have a right to set the terms and conditions of their workplaces when they're private employers, here we've got a vaccine that only has emergency use authorization. And when people go to get the vaccine, they're handed a piece of paper or they're told that they have a choice that they do or do not. They do not have to take the choices there as to whether or not they will get this vaccine. So many employers are thinking that it might be better to avoid the risk of requiring a vaccine that may have not had full authorization by the FDA by using a carrot approach as opposed to a stick, and offering perhaps rewards or incentives to get the vaccine.
Shivani, I see you're nodding. Has that been true in your experience as well?
Well, I was going to just add to what Wendy was saying, in that employers have not really had to address this yet, but certainly are thinking about it and planning for it. And the EEOC, which is the federal agency that adjudicates the discrimination laws, did put out some guidance about a month ago in regards to this, in which they essentially said that employers can require their employees to take the vaccine if it is to address the health and security of their employees, but there's caveats to that. The employers are going to have to be ready to engage with employees in the interactive process if an employee is saying, hey, no, I don't want to take this because I have either a physical or a mental disability, or I have what the EEOC is calling sincere religious opposition to taking the vaccine. And so employers in those situations will have to have discussions with these employees and possibly reasonably accommodate them.
Tom, you have a pretty wide breadth of different types of industries that you're working with. Are there some that might be more sensitive than others and would be in a position where they would have to have a stronger requirement for the vaccine?
I think in an industry where you have a lot of just inherent interaction between employees or between employees and the public, there is a greater risk of transmission. And that is probably where I think employers are going to face the greatest pressure in perhaps insisting that employees receive the vaccine. And I think employers are going to be hard pressed to make a decision. If an employer is working in an industry where work can be done remotely, perhaps as many people are working right now, working from home, the pressures are reduced. So it's really going to vary quite a lot. I would say healthcare, retail, and I think places where people are going to be gathered, that's where it's going to be the most pressing issue.
So taking that to the next step and looking at an arena that we're all familiar with, which is legal, it might be that someone working in the jail probably, or to a lesser extent, maybe somebody who has to go to court every day, may take, you know, maybe subject to a little more nudging because they're dealing with the public than perhaps somebody who works out of their house and gives advice.
I think that's right.
Let me turn it over to Dean from Belmont. Dean, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. I was recently an employee at a local department store, and there were cameras everywhere, including in the break room. I don't know if the cameras recorded audio or not, but we were always under camera surveillance. And my question is this an invasion of my privacy, or at any point could it be an invasion of my privacy?
When you say this, do you mean that are the cameras that you're looking at hidden in the stores and the like, are they an invasion of your privacy?
Are the cameras in the stores that are recording the employees while we're in the break room invasion of our privacy?
That poses an interesting question, and I will turn it over to my panel, but with the suggestion that I think what you're asking about is whether there's times and places where, as an employee, you would have a diminished expectation of privacy as opposed to other areas. And I'm only guessing, and I'll throw this out to my guest, that a camera in the break room is probably less offensive than a camera in the bathroom. But and I see nodding. I see nodding from two of you. Tom, you were nodding fastest and most furiously. Why don't you jump in?
The break room is typically going to be the employer's property. And many times an employer is going to post things in places where the employer does business. It could be, you know, the floor of the retail store. It could be a break room. It could be, you know, offices there are surveillance cameras for various reasons to prevent pilferage and so forth. I don't think there's going to be an expectation of privacy that's going to prohibit the employer from necessarily filming in that area. As far as recording, I mean, you know, maybe that's another issue. Definitely, you know, Jeff posed the situation of the restroom. That's not permissible. But I think generally speaking, in a retail setting, in a store, in a break room, yes, that would be allowed.
I look at it from a little different perspective, and that is, and I'm saying this because it might pose a suggestion to my guest, but I look at it from the perspective of a criminal attorney, an attorney that practices criminal law. I'm not a criminal myself, but in looking at expectations of privacy, and we have much greater expectation of privacy in our home or in our person than we would, for example, walking into the airport. And I suspect that these zones of privacy, this greater expectation in an area searched, may be somewhat analogous in an employment situation. Are there areas where employees have much greater expectations, Wendy?
Well, I was just going to say, I think Tom really spoke well on the subject of, you know, defining what is your expectation of privacy. Where would an employee feel that the employee is expecting that nobody's watching or listening? And I do think that Tom also points out a good distinction between the listening component, the recording, and the watching component, because there has been some discussion about the fact that while an employer might have a right and an employee might expect that the employer is going to watch what's going on, that the employer might not have a need to be listening in. So there may be a distinction there. But I would think that in terms of places on the property, other than the bathroom, every place walking up to the property and on the property would seem to be fair game, other than something like a dressing room or a place where you would not expect anybody to be watching.
And certainly from Dean's question, it sounds like we're talking about a retail environment where there might be small things to go, whereas if, you know, that could travel with them. Whereas if we're talking about a dealer of monster trucks, maybe a little less scrutiny. Dean, I believe you had a follow-up question from what you said.
Yeah, thank you. So, Jeff, I got this friend who was working at the same department store, and she didn't do something they were supposed to do. So they're working as a cashier, and they didn't scan certain items when a family member came in. They got caught. They were fired. Now, he or she receives this civil demand letter in the mail, and they want to know whether or not they should pay it.
You know, I think you're going to hear one set of answers from my guest and maybe a different answer, maybe the same answer from yours truly, but I'll turn it to my guest first.
If I could just get clarification, where did the civil demand come from?
It came from a law firm.
To the employee who got terminated?
Yes.
Asking for what?
They're asking for money. They were saying that the items that weren't rung up basically was lost in store, and they're entitled under this code they cited, like $490 or something, to up to $500 in damages, and was threatened to take them to court if they didn't pay the demand.
You know, I see those letters myself in my own practice as well. And oftentimes it's somebody who's been accused of shoplifting or participating. And I have two observations that are relevant to your question. One of them is, after that experience, you probably want to do anything you can to calm and quiet things down. Particularly the police have not yet been involved. You can't come out and say, don't call the police or I'll get mad or I'll do something. But cooperating might not be a bad idea in avoiding that. The letters themselves in general are, in my experience, not much more than a shakedown. They may come from the store internally. They may come from a third-party law firm. They generally don't really go to deter the theft. They're not going to enhance security. They may go towards some other things, and I don't want to open myself up to liability by telling you what I have come to understand after years of doing this. But there's oftentimes very little connection between these shakedown letters and whether somebody ultimately gets prosecuted or not.
Would they be sent any kind of because there hasn't been a criminal case, but could this affect their employment going forward? Is there any way a future employer could see that this had happened?
In a short answer, from a legal, from a criminal law perspective, once the police are involved, yes, it will be potentially available through any one of a number of arenas, especially if somebody's arrested at some point and brought to the jail. But every layer of contact with the outside opens the possibility that people are going to find it later. Now, assuming the police are not involved and assuming that it's never going to be prosecuted, would those same things be true from an employment perspective? Basically, the more you've peeled off the layers, the more you've gotten further into the onion, the more likely it is that somebody's going to smell it. I see a laughter from Tom. I see nodding from Shivana. Who would like to take that one on?
Well, I could speak a bit to what I think you're talking about, which is background checks. Is this going to show up on a background check?
Basically, yes. And someone told me there's some kind of national database or something for people who are involved in this type of retail theft or shoplifting. And I'm afraid of my friend being on that, if there's a database that a future employer could see that when they were applying for a new job.
I'm not aware of the database, but employers do have a right to run a background check after they have provided a conditional offer. But the decisions that an employer makes based on what they may see on a background check is restricted by the law to a certain extent. There needs to be a nexus between what they're seeing on the background check and what job the person is applying for. Also, in California, employers are not supposed to take into consideration an arrest without a further conviction. So it depends on, in this situation, how far this ends up going and if there's actual litigation and if it's going to show up on the background check.
I see. Thank you.
Dean, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff. Have a good show.
Thank you. Let me ask my guest, what are some of the trends in COVID-related litigation going on right now? Who would like to speak to that first?
I can mention a few things that we're seeing. We have seen some wrongful death claims brought by families of essential workers, the people who have been going to work, where there have been challenges to the safety in the workplace. And we're seeing some claims that for those employees that are working at home, that their employers are not reimbursing them properly for business expenses under California law. So you have both, you know, some of the litigation happening for the, for those in the workplace who are back to work, and then you have some of the litigation for those who are working remotely. And there are a myriad of other things in between.
Have you seen anything outside, any additional stuff, Tom or Shivani?
Well, I would add that there have been a number of issues raised about people working maybe off the clock. If they're working at home, maybe they are not following a set schedule like they would if they were in the office or in another employer facility. When do they take their breaks? When do they take their meal period? Those sorts of things are very strictly regulated by California law, and the rules are very worker friendly. Unless an employer can establish that there is a set practice, and you can document, for example, that someone actually did clock out for a meal period and clock back in, the law very much favors the employee, and there are penalties associated with that. So I am expecting that we're going to see a lot of legal claims related to that for wage and hour violations, overtime penalties, and associated things like that. And, you know, we're starting to see information on issues like that arising.
And I'll also add that there's COVID-related discrimination claims on the rise as well, related to disability, related to age, related to gender.
Alrighty. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, and tonight we're taking a look at the new world of labor and employment law with Shivani Sitaria of San Mateo, and from Sidley Austin, Wendy Lazerson, and from Atkinson Andelson, Loya Rude and Romo, Thomas Lenz. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question of tonight's topic, labor and employment. You don't have to jump in right where we are in the conversation. And where we are in the conversation, we're talking about some of the COVID trends, and some of the questions now are going a little quicker, such as, can an employee refuse to wear a face mask?
I think that if an employee has a sincerely held religious belief, somehow prevents that person from wearing a face mask, or has a disability of some kind, physical or mental disability, which would prevent them from wearing a face mask, that there may be some grounds that where the employer would need to accommodate those restrictions. And but otherwise, absent some need for accommodation, I believe that an employer could send an employee home who refused to wear a face mask, because given the current state of affairs, it would pose potentially a direct threat to the safety of others in the workplace.
You know, a follow-up question I want to bounce your way. Given what I just heard, what if somebody does have a heightened problem with wearing a face mask, whether it's because of a sensitivity they have or maybe a religious belief? Is that good enough, or does that really start a balancing where maybe you weigh that against the number of people they're going to see?
Well, I think whenever you're dealing with an accommodation question, it is a balancing act, and it is the balancing act between what will the need of the employee versus the undue hardship that it imposes on the employer, and that would include the safety of the other employees. So you are absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head there, that it is a balancing act. But in that case, there might be some things that an employer could do, such as maybe isolate the employee and put that employee in a place where they would not be as exposed to others, or maybe have the employee work remotely. Again, it's the whole nature of an interactive dialogue so that something can be worked out so that employees can work, but employers can maintain a safe workplace for their employees.
We just received a call from a listener who does not want to appear on the air. Sometimes people will get their questions to me, and I will ask them in turn. And he asks, if I need to spend more time at home with my children because they're not in school now because of COVID, does my employer have to pay me when I'm at home, say half of my 40-hour week I'm at home working?
If you're working from home, then yes, you need to get paid. Is it that 20 hours they're not working and 20 hours they are working, or they are working but just at home?
And as I understood the question, does the employer have to pay for hours that I'm home? But maybe you want to answer it both ways. Maybe if they're pulled away from work, or maybe they are working out of the house.
I think that one of the first questions I would ask is how they're classified, because a non-exempt employee, which is thought of as your hourly employee, gets paid for hours worked, whereas an exempt employee gets paid the same amount regardless of how many hours they work. And so if this employee is a non-exempt employee, then they should be getting paid for the hours worked. If they are an exempt employee, the amount of hours they're working specifically shouldn't impact their pay. And in the flip situation, if they're in fact supposed to be working 40 hours but need 20 hours off because of the child care obligations, then that's certainly a discussion to have with their employer in terms of what their situation is and how they could possibly work together to work out some sort of an accommodation. I think that one thing that was available to employees in 2020 and still not as a requirement, but as an option can be available to employees, is there was a federal law related to employees taking off time because of childcare responsibilities. And there was a form of payment for that. And so that's the Federal Family Relief, Coronavirus Relief Act, which expired in December 30th, 2020, but there is now this option for it to continue up through at least March 31st. But with everything changing right now with the new administration, that very well can get reinstated at any point.
A new administration and a new Congress. This caller that sent me that question must have missed the very beginning of the show, because the other question they submitted was asking about whether an employer can make them take a COVID vaccine or a COVID test. And we answered the one about the vaccine, but we didn't necessarily address the test. Does the answer remain the same? It's really a balance of why not and what they do?
You know, I think in the case of the testing, pretty well established by the EEOC, who's come right out and said that employers can require a COVID test, not an antibody test, because the antibody tests are not deemed to be super reliable. But the viral tests, the EEOC has given us guidance, at least it did in the beginning of the pandemic, and of course things do change. But they pretty much, I think, is accepted now that an employer can require testing. But of course, there are all sorts of caveats about privacy and how the process is done and all kinds of things that go along with the process for administering a test.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights. on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or you can visit sfbar.org for more information.
So we've been talking a little bit about COVID and vaccinations, and frankly, some of these things are immediate issues right now. But there's other things that may be a little longer lasting, and I'd like to jump ahead a little bit to new laws that may be in effect. We've talked about new statutes, that's new laws that are made by the legislature and signed by the governor. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some of those that might have been brought about by COVID, because some of those may be around a lot longer than some of our current vaccination talks. For example, let's talk about what effect it's had on workers' compensation coverage. Who would like to talk about that?
Go ahead, Shivani.
We've lost our audio for a moment. Okay.
So one of the new California statutes that was passed had to do with there being what's now called a disputable presumption that an employee contracted COVID at work, and an employer... It is disputable, so an employer can show evidence of that the employee didn't contract COVID at work. But let's say they cannot show that, then there are going to be workers' comp benefits available to that employee if they choose to file a claim.
What other laws have changed a bit? Is there anything in the works or anything that's come into effect about reporting and mandatory reporting of COVID in any instances, or perhaps prohibited reporting of COVID in instances?
Go ahead.
Please, Tom.
AB 685 was enacted, and it is ramping up reporting requirements. Where an employer has to notify government agencies, employees, labor unions, and so forth, if there has been an issue with exposure in the workplace. And there are going to be, I think, penalties for this. And if an employer fails to comply with this very complex reporting requirement, but it's a bit too complicated, I would say, to go into in great detail, other than to say that employers are going to need to be mindful when there have been potential exposures, that this need to get the notice out is very, very real and new under AB 685.
What are some of the other things that we've seen change of late? Are there, when we talk about occupational health, safety and health, were in the arena of OSHA or Cal OSHA. Have they adopted any temporary standards with regard to COVID? Everybody's nodding. I see that. I would say the answer is yes. Let's talk a little bit about what those are. Tom?
Yes, Cal OSHA has implemented a set of standards, and it's an interesting set of standards that I honestly have not studied this particular topic that deeply, but I can tell you that there are pay requirements. For example, if an employee is required to go home, for example, because of a safety situation due to COVID, and that employee would otherwise be able to work, that employer may be facing a duty to pay the employee for time spent at home. So it's something completely different from not being able to work due to workers' comp injury or something like that. It's due to something in the workplace that's really not necessarily afflicting the employee, but causing that employee to be home.
Shivani, you're nodding. Is this something that carried over from the Trump administration, or is this something that's...
No, it's California specific, and these standards were passed on November 30th, 2020, and became effective immediately. Another big piece of those standards is the requirement on employers to have a written COVID prevention document. It needs to include information about what are the employer's safety protocols, what kind of training are they providing to their employees, if there is some sort of an outbreak, what is the employer's plan to address that. So this is a requirement similar to what employers have right now, which is the Injury Illness Prevention Program. This, where you have to have all these things in writing, this is now COVID specific.
Are these the kind of things the employer is going to get a giant sized poster they have to put up on the wall for everyone to see?
I think that it's actually needs to be more like a handbook. And if you go on Cal OSHA's website, they actually have created a template. So an employer can click on that and try and customize it to their own workplace.
At the federal level, are there similar changes either in place or perhaps that are afoot given the change in administration and the change in the Senate?
I would, without looking into a crystal ball, which I don't like to think that I have any talent in that regard, I think we can expect to see much more employee-friendly and employee-protective legislation coming down and more federalized legislation, so that each state will not necessarily be left to their own standards, although they may impose additional standards. But I think there may be some regulation at the federal level. And when you were talking about those posters, those giant posters, one thing I think that a lot of employers have had to deal with is that on top of the federal and the state rules, each county has had some of their own rules about what employers need to do and what they need to tell employees and what they need to post. And these have changed quite often. And so lawyers' heads are spinning, trying to keep up with all of the developments in the COVID area, I think. So I think I always say stay tuned, because what's good law today may be bad law tomorrow. So it's a rapidly moving area.
Now, we've discussed that generally in the employment front, but Tom, are there similar things going on in the labor law arena?
Yes, very much so, Jeff. And I think that this is going to be the start of a time of significant change in the labor relations field. The change of administration usually triggers new appointments, new policies on the labor relations front, and can signal a major change in direction. The labor movement was quite critical of President Trump, and they supported President Biden's candidacy, hoping that certain standards that were eroded during the Trump years could perhaps be returned to effect, and frankly, that some new rules could come into effect. And things along the lines of employee speech, employees' rights to criticize employers, civility rules where employers tried to tamp down on what employees were allowed to say and do, and rules related to workplace investigations, which really tightened up what employees could say and do, arbitration agreements, things along those lines, a lot of hot button issues, independent contractor misclassification, which many employers have allegedly used to stop union organizing. These have all been hot button issues for labor, which at the federal level, there are policy as well as legislative efforts to change that, to perhaps move back to the Obama administration standard, if not to legislate new law entirely. In fact, there is a bill called the PRO Act, or Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which President Biden has already indicated he would sign. And in many senses, it is a wish list for what organized labor has wanted from federal labor law in terms of how to organize without elections, instead using signed authorization cards, to speed up the bargaining process and impose agreements on employers where negotiations run slow, to ramp up penalties and employer liabilities, not necessarily union or employee liabilities. But also, and this one I think has gone fairly unnoticed, it would impose the ABC test for independent contractors nationally as a matter of federal law. So this is one with the change in Congress and the change in presidential administration. We will see probably in the next few months how much traction there is. But in the short term, we've already seen that the president has fired people at the top level of the National Labor Relations Board and signaled that what's gone on the past 4 years isn't going to go forward.
In a moment, I'd like to switch gears and start talking back about California noteworthy laws. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're taking a look at the new world of labor and employment law with Shivani Sutaria of San Mateo and from Sidley Austin, Wendy Lazerson, and Tom Lenz from Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rude, and Romo. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You still have a few minutes if you have additional calls. Our number, if you're outside the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. We pay for it if you call 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any labor employment law question. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. And we're moving on to talk about new noteworthy laws in California. Want to tell me a little bit about some of the things that have changed here?
Well, one of the significant laws, Jeff, relates to the compositions of boards of directors of publicly traded companies that are headquartered here in California. And in 2019, we saw a law that set a minimum for how many women must be members of the board of directors. And this year, the legislature added a requirement that there must be a certain number of members of underrepresented communities, which has a statutory definition. So that is a significant development, and there are significant penalties for companies that do not comply with those laws.
Is that a departure from what's happening in most of the country? Seems to me that that's a pretty radical step. And perhaps one that doesn't have a lot of teeth to it, given that if a company doesn't like it, they can simply buy a corporation off the shelf from another state and move it.
Well, I'm not so sure that it's going to be that easy to get around that law. But, you know, the basis of these laws are studies that show that companies that have women on the boards of directors and members of the underrepresented communities, that kind of diversity actually leads to success, and it is documented according to pretty well-established studies. So corporations might not want to be too hasty. And I think there's quite a recognition now among companies that diversity is a good thing. So we can hope that it won't just be those very steep penalties, which are $100,000 for the first violation and $300,000 for each subsequent violation. We hope that's not the only reason that companies will comply with these laws.
I presume that that's primarily aimed at larger companies. Are there acts that might...
Correct, Jeff. It's a rule that applies to publicly held companies. I get a lot of questions about whether it applies to nonprofits, and currently this standard does not. This being California and the bar always being raised, it's certainly a possibility for the future.
And let me turn it to Evan from Alameda. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, hello. I was hoping to get some help with finding appropriate attorney. I just tried today to contact most of the Bay Area lawyers and referral associations, and they don't have referrals to medical malpractice attorneys. So what other avenues might be good options?
You might try the lawyer referral service of the Alameda County Bar Association. Have you tried them?
Actually, I think that was the one that I only left a message at. Others I talked to, and they didn't have a reference. So there's that possibility, but most of them seem to not have any attorneys in their roster for that issue.
I would start there, given that you're in Alameda. Their number is 510-302.
Who are you talking about here?
That would be the Alameda County Bar Association and the Lawyer Referral Service.
I left a message with them. I haven't heard back from them.
You might also check in San Francisco, San Mateo, some of the surrounding counties.
I've called all of them and gotten nowhere, except for Alameda that's going to call me back. So are there other avenues that are good for tracking down an attorney? Like I've tried, looking at Google Scholar and try to find similar cases in the right jurisdiction and nail one of those attorneys. Any other suggestions?
Contact me offline at ylr@kalw.org. YLR as in Your Legal Rights at kalw.org. And I will contact some of the folks I know at the leadership of the bar associations around and see if I can't get you a lawyer referral service that's geared towards your needs. I won't refer an individual attorney, but I will find you the right place that can do that.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Let me turn it to Joy in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question regarding employment in San Francisco. I work an 8-hour shift, and my lunch break is included, which we get 30 minutes, and then we get 2 15-minute breaks. And as of the beginning of February, they're changing it. They want us to come in a half hour early because they don't want to pay for the lunch break. And basically, I'll be there 8.5 hours, but the half hour is an unpaid, uninterrupted break. And I understand that there's a lawsuit going on with the company because of somebody suing for not getting their lunch breaks. So now they're making all the sites go this way where you have to be there a half hour early, but you're not paid for that half hour. Is that legal? Hello?
Before anybody tries to answer your question, let me ask you a couple questions that'll help focus which of my guests should be jumping on this. Is it a large employer or a smaller one?
Very large.
Is there a union contract involved?
Yes.
So maybe that helps. Tom, do you want to take a crack at that one?
Well, if a union contract is involved, that agreement probably addresses pay and ways in which workplace disputes can be resolved, possibly through a grievance procedure. That's not to say that it's the only way in which a pay dispute can be resolved, but it provides a mechanism. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the company is trying to channel a dispute like this into the grievance procedure and trying to maybe get a lawsuit sidetracked in order to do that. But it's still possible to seek relief at the labor commissioner for time worked for which someone is not paid. And I think this is an area where there's usually not a specific clean answer. Employees' rights to receive pay for hours worked are, I'd say, sacred under the law. And while a grievance arbitration process under a labor agreement is a vehicle and something negotiated by a union as your representative, it's perhaps not the only way to receive pay to which you are due.
I have to say that I mentioned that I don't want the half hour. Like, why can't I have an option to not take that half hour, uninterrupted break, and that way I wouldn't be having to come to work a half hour early? And they said, no, the law says that you must work. When you work 8 hours, you have to have that half hour. It's the law, and you can't get out of it, even if you don't want to take it. You're subjected to it.
It's my, and my guest will be in a better position to answer this than I will, but it's my understanding for many, many years, decades, that if your shift is longer than 6 hours, you're entitled to that break. And if you don't take a break after 4 hours, you're limited to a six-hour shift. You can't work an eight-hour day. Is that essentially what it is today?
No, it's an eight-hour shift, but I work by myself. I'm in the security business, and I work in a lobby on a weekend where there's no traffic of people, and the whole job is pretty much laid back. There's no people coming in or out of the building, and I'm on a, I can eat at the front desk and other than go to the restroom. So I think it's ludicrous that I have to come in a half hour early just because, because they're coming down with the law. And I guess I'm going to have to take this up with the union, but when I was listening to your program, I thought this might be something that you might be able to give me some advice on, because the union, I haven't dealt with them in the I have never dealt with the union, but I mean, I imagine it's legal because they wouldn't be doing this if they, if it wasn't a legal situation.
I think it would be wise to talk to the union, and the phrasing of your agreement as well as the past practice with this employer may well inform how your situation should be handled. But generally speaking, the meal and rest periods are things that are hard to contract around. There are some, I would say, easings of the legal rules in the unionized environment pursuant to California law. But I think that conversation would be time well spent.
If okay, only to tell you what's in the agreement, which you may not be privy to right now, and to know exactly what the people representing you have agreed to over the years and what your employer has done about it. And knowing your starting point, it would be a good time well spent, I think.
Well, I really appreciate the advice, because I'm very perturbed about it, and I wouldn't even mind signing a paper saying that I don't need the half hour. And that would alleviate me from having to come to work a half hour early in the morning, which they told me, well, you can't get out of it. Well, maybe I can't get out of it, but I could exercise my legal rights in terms of the union. But because it's union, I can't get too much advice from outside, because the union has it all sewed up in a contract, correct?
Start by finding out what's in the contract and what the practice has been. That's not to say that there isn't any wiggle room, but you need to know where you're starting from and what you've agreed to by virtue of being a part of that process.
Well, it's the first time this has happened because I know other sites are telling me, oh, we have to come to work a half hour early. And eventually they say all the sites are going to be going along with this, whereas, you know, this will save money for the client who is paying for my service. And at this point, the client is coughing up the half hour because my half hour is included in my 8-hour shift.
I understand. And you also would not be wasting time to talk to your union rep and see if you can get a feel for where this change is coming from and whether it's coming from your employer or whether it's coming from the entity that's contracting for your labor. That may lead you to a different direction as well. We're virtually out of time, but I wanted to thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We have only a couple minutes left before we go to close out, and I wanted to ask a couple of questions. We've done whole programs on independent contractor classification and then Prop 22. Has anything changed of late?
Well, yes. The biggest change now that we have Prop 22 is that the Supreme Court of California just came down with a decision that said as to the time before Prop 22, that the law is what the law was. So in other words, the case that established the rules of independent contractor are retroactive. Going forward, we have Prop 22, but going backwards, we have a case called Dynamex, which is deemed retroactive and sets the rules. So it's going to be very interesting to see now what litigation ensues over the law of independent contractor in California.
And just to clarify a little bit on that, Prop 22 was the California ballot initiative that was specific to app-based driving companies. So the independent contractor test for all other industries in California was AB5. And the retroactive provision is related to, which was already mentioned, the ABC test. And if you can use that test for claims that or for employment situations prior to the Dynamex case coming down in 2018. And also there was a new California statute passed, AB 2257, which was an addition to AB5. And there's just
I hate to cut you short, but we are totally out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights. Tonight, we took a look at the new world of labor and employment law. This show has been produced by Joshua Borger and yours truly. Our guests tonight have been Shivani Sutaria of San Mateo, from Sidley Austin, Wendy Lazerson, and from Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rude, and Romo, Thomas Lenz. To all of our guests, thank you for joining us. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, where we'll go back to school. That is, talk a bit about your rights at school. Once again, to our distinguished guests, Tom Lenz, Wendy Lazerson, Shivani Sutaria, our thanks to EGB for joining us. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Please call 415-989-1616 or you can visit sfbar.org for more information.